mentality change.
Yeah, so one thing about this time, like seminary Hausa, is that, you know, it's become more advanced.
Yes.
So now it's easier for you to gain access to different
knowledge,
books and different knowledge and different fields of knowledge. But with that, accordingly, you have a vast ocean of knowledge.
Yes.
You also have vast amount of distraction. But in the past times, you didn't have much like digital books or the PDFs, which we use nowadays. You don't have to just buy a book and you can carry, you know, the whole digital library wherever
exactly.
you go.
Exactly. Instead of carrying books, you just carry your cell phone and that's enough.
But in those days, you had to have the books, your teacher go and you consult with them. This day, even people who want to gain Islamic knowledge, even if they don't want to leave their country, as of we know that the Hausa, like the main Hausas in different countries like Iran, Iraq, like in Najaf, and you know in Syria and Lebanon as well.
Yes.
So now in Iran, if you talk about the Hausa Ilmiya Qom, there are students from across 150 countries or more than that.
Many nationalities.
Many nationalities.
Have been gathered all together.
But if we talk about the past, you know, the previous Islamic seminary, there used to be students from hardly few countries.
Yes.
Like the Arabs, the Iranians, and the Indians and
Well,
Pakistanis.
Keep it there. Let's have Brother Jafar. Let's bring him into speaking.
Look, there wasn't that much variety back in the day. It was difficult to come to the seminary back in the day. Nowadays, it's easier. Now you can have someone who's living, say, 3,000 miles away, hop on a plane and come to the seminary.
Yes, everything is more available.
It's more advanced. It's more available. But then the main backbone of the seminary was made in the past, right? You can't deny that. The stuff that we have now is a recollection from the past.
Yes, you owe them to the past.
They were the guys who put in the work, who really, you know, grinded out these books, try to make it somewhat easier for us to understand and grasp nowadays. But then again, in one aspect, it was harder for people outside of the seminary to gain knowledge.
Yes.
One point to be mentioned over here, the books we are studying in the seminary now are the books of ahadith and different narratives which have been compiled by the scholars from the past times.
Exactly.
You know, it was their struggle.
So the hardships has been done.
Many hardships. You know, if you talk about the book Lum'a, you know, the book of jurisprudence.
Yes.
It was written by Shahid Awal, the first martyr.
Yes.
Sheikh Muhammad Jamaluddin al-Makki.
Yes.
Al-Amili. So he's the author of the book Lum'a.
Yes.
Which we get, we derive the Islamic laws from, which he have compiled the ahadith and narratives from the Ma'asumin alayhim as-salam. He was in certain, you know, hardships, you know, there were enemies and also he wrote that book.
Yes. They did those things in a time where those things were banned, mostly.
Exactly.
The things that have been brought to us has been made with many difficulties.
Yeah, the previous scholar, exactly, they have, you know, they have passed through all these trials and hardships.
Yes. Now, for those who are listening to us, maybe they don't exactly know what we're talking about. We're talking about the life of seminary students and how it has changed through the ages and years.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
So now you two are students and you come from different nationalities as far as I know. So many people from other sides of the world do not know about these sorts of study. You know what I mean? How they react to you? They do not know anything about the situation in these schools, let's say.
When people get to know that I'm an Islamic seminary student, like the first question, like, is there an Islamic seminary? Like, what subjects do you guys study?
Like, that's the first impression they get.
Yeah, like,
because they think it's the typical, you know, math, science, history. That's what you're studying, like any other, say, college.
Yes, it's not like the college or universities.
In some ways it is, in some ways it isn't. As in, like, you
still
have courses.
But back in time it wasn't. Back in time,
yeah,
it wasn't.
Back in the day, it wasn't. And it was more based on...
like the traditional way.
Classical.
The
sunnah,
it was a more traditional approach towards this.
Let's just give people a picture of how it was in the past. The schools were created like maybe big houses that had many rooms.
Yeah, it was based off of, say, a building with many rooms,
yes,
that could house 25 to 50 students.
And it has built upon Islamic architecture.
Yeah, not necessarily rooms, just one big hall. You know, in big hall, like there are students sitting with different teachers. Like, you know, different groups.
Yes.
You know, a teacher with 5 students, and there's another group.
You know, but it has to be their dorm as well.
In both senses. They would have halls for the dormitories as well, and for classes as well. The concept of sectionalizing these classes is nowadays where it's like, okay, this class is specific for this subject, and this teacher will come in and teach at that time.
Nowadays, it's more the format of their buildings is just like a university, right?
Yeah, they've taken the structure from a university and tried to, in a sense, combine the two. Mm-hmm. You have the traditional style of the seminary back in the day, and you have the modern university college like outlook. And what they're trying to do now is combine the two.
Since the population has grown, then they have to create such a big building for students.
Yeah, so
that's why it's more like universities nowadays.
Yeah, and the classes that you know, we go to are like, you know, a proper classroom, like with whiteboard and, you know, seats to be seated on and teacher, you know, explaining you the stuff. But the traditional
way...
And
how many courses do you have? Are they more than 50s?
Each semester, we have
minimum
3 to 4.
Of 4.
Yeah, it depends, on what field you have chosen.
Yes.
So, this is the system, nowadays.
Yes.
But the old traditional way, which still happens, you know, at some houses or some seminaries, the teacher sits on the floor, and the students gather around him. They circle around the ustad.
Mm-hmm. Which one do you agree and like more? One is better as a student of... Islamic study, I would ask you this question. Which form do you like more? To sit around your teacher on the floor?
I think we're a little more biased towards the new structure because that's the only structure we've seen.
I feel, you know, when you're sitting down on the floor with the teacher, when you have circled around him, I guess that, you know, there's more interaction between the teacher and the student.
Yes, based on what we've seen in TV or documentaries, I think that form is a more classical way of studying. Which brings you more into studying.
Yeah,
there's more of a connection between the students with one another
the
and then also the student and the teacher. Nowadays, it's more, I guess, more functional to a sense where you put a couple of students with a teacher in one room and say, look, you teach them. But back in the day, there was, other than just, say, the lesson and learning from that lesson, there was more of a camaraderie between the students with one another, and then also the students with the teacher.
Now, tell us about your subjects. Have they changed through the ages? I mean, what you study now was exactly the thing people used to study 50 years ago?
The old subjects did not change, but there have been add-ons. There have been the new subjects coming in. But the old subjects still remain because, you know, it's a part of our studies, Islamic studies. You may say that the subjects like, you know, on economy, and, you know, these new subjects have been added on. But the old subjects, they still remain.
So the structure is the same?
Yeah, structure is the same, you know.
Depending on how time changed and different factors were added in, they increased the amount that's taught now.
Yes.
Say, even, like, if you look at now and say 100 years from now, there's going to be new topics that maybe we haven't faced.
Yeah, well, the need of the hour.
Exactly. By the need of the era, everything changes.
When we talk about the subjects being added to the Islamic seminary, what I feel like, you know, basically, it doesn't make sense that the subject is being added to, you know, the Islamic studies. Mm-hmm. Because as we believe that, you know, Islam is a complete religion, it was completed in the time of the Holy Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. So rather than saying that the subject being added, we would say that, you know, subject was discovered more deeply and was being highlighted. Like, with respect to the time, you know, in this era, you have to gain knowledge about the banking system.
Because, you know, as we go by the time, in past, as you said, just we didn't have banking accounts or something like that. We didn't have science this much improving.
Yeah.
So about medical questions. So there are many things that has changed.
It's nothing out of Islam.
please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
And you have some very perfect professors right now, right?
Alhamdulillah, yeah. You get different type of teachers.
In past, students used to sit in a class where the teacher, only his name was such a, how to say it, he was such a well-known and famous alim, let's say. Mm-hmm. So the students used to be in touch with the main source of knowledge, yeah. Right? But nowadays, I think it's...
It's the students of that original teacher.
Yes, yes.
The students of his students.
Mm-hmm. Just for those who do not know much about those teachers who have got a very famous reputation in Islamic world, can you just mention the name of some of them?
So you have Shahid Awwal and Shahid Thani in the...
We talked about Shahid Awwal, and who is Shahid Thani?
Shahid Thani is... In a sense, it's his student who went in and made his work a little easier for the next generation, for the next class, for the next era that was coming through. He made it a little simpler.
As Zainuddin, as Shahid Thani. You know, the teacher of all teachers is believed to be Imam Jafar Sadiq alayhi salam. And his father...
The creator of the...
Yeah, the creator of the...
The concept of the seminary. System,
the, yes. The concept of the seminary. And his father, Imam Baqir alayhi salam, as he's called, Baqir al-Ulum.
Baqir al-Ulum.
Baqir al-Ulum can be translated in English the splitter of knowledge.
Yes.
The one who splits the knowledge.
Discovers many aspects of knowledge.
Yeah, and apart from that, he
removes... The door to all knowledge.
Yeah, the door to all knowledge. Yeah. And apart from that, he also removes the, you know, the wrong things, like from the right stuff.
Yes.
Yeah.
Any doubts, any stipulations you have,
he's
there to clear it all.
Mm-hmm.
So there have been some great scholars and great teachers in our times as well.
Yes.
These days, you know, the tafsir, the interpretations of the Holy Quran that we read, the famous ones, if you talk about Al-Mizan,
yes,
which is from Allama Tabatabai, you know, we have got some really good books from them. And I guess Al-Mizan has been translated in English as well.
It's not just English, in many other languages.
Yeah, in many other languages.
Yes, it's a very important book, an Islamic heritage.
And the students are still present, who are still, you know, proceeding with that same work. Ayatollah Behjat,
you have Ayatollah
the mystic, the arif.
Yes.
You have
Ayatollah Marashi.
Ayatollah Marashi, who has a famous library here in Qom as well.
Yes.
And then you have Ayatollah Misbah Yazdi, who, in a sense, he's continued the paved way of philosophy.
He was very famous in philosophy.
We have Shahid Mutahhari.
Plenty much more of names, if you want to mention, that we owe them a lot, as in Islamic heritage. They have paved the road for us to learn more and to discover more. So we could talk more about this very interesting topic, but this is all the time we have. Thank you for listening to us. Until another session of Back to Reality, we bid you farewell, and I leave you to Allah's never-sleeping eyes.
Ya Allah, let the ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
A delegation from the International Academic Campaign Against Occupation and Apartheid headed to the offices of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, OHCHR, as well as the UN Special Coordinator's Office, UNSCO, in Gaza. They handed the memorandum on Israeli apartheid signed by around 70 international organizations, human rights networks, academics, and researchers from 45 countries. The campaign is calling on the United Nations and Western countries to impose sanctions on the Israeli regime for its occupation of the Palestinian territories and its apartheid regime. The Israeli regime is an occupying power and has kept the Gaza Strip under a crippling blockade since 2007 and also waged four wars on the tiny enclave.
We are here to condemn Israeli apartheid, and we call on the international community to support the Palestinian people. We also demand and end the Israeli crimes. Israeli leaders must face justice for their crimes against the Palestinian people.
Tel Aviv also practices apartheid policies against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Among Israel's apartheid policies is the demolition of Palestinian homes in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Israel also keeps thousands of Palestinian prisoners in its jails under inhumane detention conditions. Israeli forces also use excessive force to kill and maim peaceful Palestinian protesters in the blockaded Gaza Strip as well as in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds.
Today we are here to prove that the crimes of the occupations against the Palestinians and the prisoners must be documented and to support the Palestinians to obtain their rights.
Last month, at least 277 human rights groups and civil society organizations around the world denounced Israeli officials for imposing apartheid on Palestinians.
Observers say that Israel's apartheid against Palestinians is a cruel system of domination that constitutes a crime against humanity. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian arrived in Damascus heading a high-ranking delegation. He met with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and discussed the implementation of bilateral cooperation agreements. Talks covered cooperation in fighting terrorism, in which Abdullahian renewed Iran's support to Syria for the full liberation of all its territories. The top diplomat briefed President Assad on the Vienna talks on the revival of the JCPOA. Assad hailed Iran for adhering to principles and rights in the track adopted during the negotiations. He asserted that reaching a deal has become more important in service of Iran and the region's interest as well as international equilibrium.
We had good meetings with President Assad and Foreign Minister Faisal Maqtet. We welcome the new approach by some Arab states in restoring relations with Syria. We reaffirmed Iran's readiness to develop relations with Syria and discuss increasing the level of tourist exchange. We hope that in the near future, the presidents of both countries would meet.
A separate meeting was also held between the foreign ministers of Syria and Iran. Focus was laid on the notable increase of trade exchange and means of overcoming the impact of economic sanctions on the two countries.
We discussed means of confronting unilateral illegal sanctions on both states as well as developments currently happening in the meetings of the Syrian Constitutional Committee in Geneva. Syria and Iran's stances are identical in this regard. We are in favor of a successful result. However, the other side is not working for national interests.
Syria was the first destination of the regional tour of the Iranian delegation, which also includes Lebanon. Abdullahian's visit is one of many exchanged between both countries' officials. It signals the extensive and continuous cooperation between the two allies at all times, which resulted in a defeat of terror in Syria and currently aims to boost economic partnerships. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Poland's support for fellow Europeans fleeing Ukraine is receiving much praise. However, this has been a huge turnaround, for in past years, the Eastern European country has been heavily criticized for a proud anti-immigration stance, particularly hostile towards Muslim refugees.
Angela Merkel started this madness, and now this is a problem about Muslims mainly coming to Europe.
Amid the anti-Islam rhetoric, Press TV decided to investigate how local Muslims live under these types of challenges.
The Muslim community that lives here in Poland is small but very passionate. It's estimated somewhere between 25 to 40,000 Muslims currently live in the country, making up about 0.1% of the current population, as it's estimated. The majority of them are native Tatars, but also there has been an immigration of Muslims to Poland from various countries. We've come here to one of the main mosques in the capital, Warsaw, to meet the community firsthand.
The imam explained that his main focus has always been to re-educate Poles about Islam and demonstrate Islamic teachings through good deeds.
We teach Quran, we teach Arabic language, and we teach something about Islam. Yes. During Ramadan, because Ramadan is near now, we're making soon 1992, we're making food and iftar for everybody, every day. From time to time, also, we're making open day. This is for non-Muslims to come to our mosque to hear something and listen about Islam. We made in March open day. And during this activity, 5 women accept Islam.
Despite these successes, Islamophobia still rears its ugly head from time to time. But the mosque uses Islam to combat this also.
One time only, the Polish youth came in front of this masjid and said some bad words about Islam. But I went to them and invited them to here to take a cup of tea, and they became friendly.
In past years, it was Islamic immigration that was considered the major threat in Eastern Europe. Now it's Russia. But conflict in Europe has historically catapulted dangerous ideologies into the forefront. Muslims in Europe look on with caution. Robert Carter, Warsaw.
Yemen's Eye of Humanity Center for Rights and Development has held a press conference in the capital Sana'a to release its latest statistics of 7 years of Saudi Arabia's war and siege on its neighboring Arab country. The report says more than 46,000 civilians have been killed or injured, including women and the children.
During 7 years, the Saudi-led coalition committed horrific crimes amounting to genocide. There were 46,262 civilians who got killed and wounded as a result of the direct targeting of the Saudi-led coalition's aircraft, including more than 8,000 children and 5,000 women. There is also systematic destruction and targeting of service and economic infrastructure, and the Saudi coalition's air force continues to target roads, bridges, and civilian objects to this day.
The report says more than 500,000 homes were destroyed due to Saudi Arabia's air attacks and thousands of families were displaced. Also, the figures show further destruction of the country's infrastructure.
For 7 years, Saudi Arabia has committed war crimes against Yemeni civilians, but unfortunately, the international community did not fulfill its duty to stop these crimes. Therefore, we see today the Yemeni army intensifying its operations against Saudi territories, and this is a legitimate right, as it is self-defense.
Since the beginning of the war, Saudi Arabia has clearly violated international law multiple times by targeting residential areas across Yemen using cluster munitions. However, this has not pushed the international community to take any measures against Riyadh's war crimes.
After 7 years of killing and destruction in Yemen, observers say Saudi Arabia has not achieved any of its announced goals. On the contrary, Riyadh is facing more retaliatory attacks by the Yemeni forces deep inside its territory. Al-Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
This is the second OIC conference Pakistan hosted in 3 months. In December, foreign ministers from the OIC held an extraordinary session to discuss the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. But the latest session was a regular one with an ambitious agenda on the table. Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan opened the conference while regretting how the OIC failed both the people of Palestine and Kashmir.
We have failed both the Palestinians and the people of Kashmir. I'm sad to say that we have been able to make no impact at all. They don't take us seriously. We are a divided house, and those powers know it.
For the first time, the Chinese foreign minister attended the OIC conference as a special guest. In his speech, Wang, he said Beijing wants to work closely with the Islamic countries.
China stands ready to work with the Islamic countries to actively advocate true multilateralism, safeguard the purposes and principles of the UN Charter, uphold the UN-centered international system.
The issue of Ukraine also came up for discussions. The OIC Secretary General stressed the need for political solution to the crisis, as he feared the conflict would endanger international peace and stability. The OIC conference coincided with Pakistan Day celebrations. The delegates also attended the National Day parade.
The two-day conference concluded with OIC members adopting over 100 resolutions. But observers believe that Islamic countries representing 1.5 billion people need to make a difference through actions, as mere statements are not enough. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Cartoons often have the power, by drawing attention quickly and getting straight to the point, to uncover deceit and deliver uncomfortable, shocking messages. In a span of over 25 years since the early 60s, late Palestinian cartoonist Naji al-Ali produced over 40,000 drawings and several books of cartoons, raising awareness on the Palestinian plight at the hands of Israeli settlers and harshly criticizing Arab regimes and the U.S. imperialistic policies. Today, a book containing tens of cartoons by al-Ali has been published for the first time in Italy.
We have published this book because presently the Palestinian struggle has been put on hold. Nobody talks about it anymore, but the Israeli occupation continues and the elimination of an entire population is ongoing. Ali and his character, Handallah, serve as an example of how a cartoon can be more useful than an intifada to stop the occupation and lift the veil of lies covering Palestine.
Naji al-Ali's most famous character is Handallah, a 10-year-old barefoot child dressed in ragged clothes. The boy, always drawn from behind while watching all the bad that is happening on Earth, has over time become a symbol of the Palestinian resistance, giving voice to the poor and oppressed. This year marks the 35th anniversary of the assassination of Handallah's creator Naji al-Ali, as he was murdered outside a newspaper office in the UK in 1987. 5 years ago, London's police department reopened its investigation into the unsolved murder of the Palestinian political cartoonist.
Naji al-Ali's work was for a long time reflective of the Palestinian cause. His cartoons were very critical of everybody involved in the Palestinian plight. Handallah means bitter in Arabic and well represents the struggle of the Palestinians. The fact that the boy was drawn from behind meant that everybody, including the Arabic world, had turned their back to Palestine. Al-Ali's assassination was plotted by dark powers, certainly close to the Mossad.
Naji al-Ali's book was recently launched in Naples. It will also be presented in several other Italian cities, including Rome, Genoa, and Bologna. Max Civili, Rome.
On World Water Day, water pollution has reached an alarming level in the besieged Gaza Strip. The enclave's coastal aquifer is almost completely polluted with various contaminants. The groundwater in Gaza has high levels of nitrates and other dangerous pollutants, with contamination levels 3 times higher than international standards for safe drinking water. The Israeli regime has imposed tight restrictions on the entry of badly needed equipment to maintain water and sewer systems and targeted them during wars.
Today, about 98% of our municipal water wells, drinking water wells, their water quality does not fit with the WHO standards related to the drinking water standards.
In recent years, Gaza municipalities were forced to pump untreated raw sewage directly into the sea due to lack of electricity for treatment plants. Raw sewage seepage into the ground has worsened the water crisis. Palestinian officials say Israel has for years deprived residents of Gaza of healthy water supply and stolen their underground resources.
Israel tried to steal our groundwater by having their bombing wells along the eastern border of Gaza Strip and preventing the flow of groundwater by gravity, by lowering the water table and reverse the direction of the groundwater at that location.
The Israeli blockade and wars have taken their toll on Gaza's water infrastructure. Experts say the tiny seaside sliver is currently in a chronic state of water emergency.
Gaza is suffering due to the water catastrophe, with full meaning, shortage of water. At the same time, we have polluted water. We are calling on the international community in order to end this blockade, which is one of the main reasons for such catastrophe that we are living in.
According to human rights organizations, depriving people of water supplies is a clear breach of international law.
On World Water Day, experts say that the complete lifting of the Israeli blockade is the first step towards easing the water crisis in the coastal enclave. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Amid the ongoing fuel crisis in Yemen, the Ministry of Human Rights has held a press conference in front of the United Nations office in Yemen's capital Sana'a to shed further light on the catastrophic consequences of Saudi Arabia's illegal seizure of Yemen's oil ships.
The intensification of the siege and the attempt to harm the public service sectors, especially the health sector, which needs electricity permanently, will cause more civilians, including women and children, to be killed. We believe that the United Nations is seeking to prolong the war to benefit from the donor countries' funds, and also because it grants fuel ships transit permits and then provides political cover-up for the piracy acts carried out by the Saudi-led coalition.
Ministry of Human Rights says the fuel crisis has impacted all aspects of life in the war-torn country, including healthcare services, transportation, and public services.
We held this press conference in the presence of many service sector officials to send a message to the world that those who pay lip service to human rights are themselves besieging the Yemeni people. The humanitarian situation today continues to deteriorate, and the Saudi blockade has affected all aspects of life, including the health sector, transportation, and public services. The international community must take serious steps to end the Saudi war on Yemen as they seek to end the Russian-Ukrainian conflict.
Recently, Saudi Arabia has been tightening the blockade it has imposed on Yemen and has prevented the entry of fuel ships to Hodeidah port despite obtaining UN permits. This has led Yemen to the worst fuel crisis since the beginning of the war on March 2015.
People here say the Yemeni army's recent retaliatory attacks against Saudi Arabia's vital facilities are a normal reaction to Riyadh's illegal measures against Yemen's fuel imports. They believe that the Yemeni army will eventually break the Saudi siege, as Riyadh only understands the language of force. Abdullah Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Since late last week, France has seen nationwide anti-government protests almost every day. March 17th's protests were over better pay and working conditions. March 19th saw the yellow vests and protests against state-sponsored Islamophobia and racism. While March 21st saw the record price of gasoline cause taxi drivers, truckers, fishermen, and others to protest nationwide. President Emmanuel Macron has joined the European Union's unprecedented sanction drive against top energy supplier Russia for its military operation in Ukraine, regardless of the economic costs on the average French household. The price of petrol has crossed the psychological barrier of 2 euros per liter, creating inflation in goods across the board. Those on low and fixed incomes are now being told to make sacrifices by politicians who may be living far more comfortable lifestyles.
I think that people are really suffering. Unfortunately, this doesn't mean much to our leaders. There are elderly people who live off canned sardines, if not canned cat food. French politics is 30 years behind where it should be. And if it doesn't change, there might be a civil war here.
Adding to the hardships being asked of the average French voter, Macron recently announced that if re-elected, he will raise the retirement age to 65. That has caused the left-wing candidate, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, to jump in the first-round polls to third place, but he still trails the far-right's Marine Le Pen by several points.
They aren't even talking about inflation and the election campaign. For everyone in France, it's big news, but not to our candidates. Everyone who isn't rich is wondering if the energy price increases are ever going to stop, while the poor wonder if they are ever going to be targeted by government aid.
While inflation has soared, it's not like this is a new problem for the average French person. Despite long-time official claims of low inflation, reduced purchasing power has been the number one issue for voters in 2017 and 2012 as well. There will be at least two more days of nationwide protests this week. France's first-round presidential vote is now less than 3 weeks away. Many are saying that the final days of Macron's five-year term are ending in a typical fashion, full of anti-government protests. Rami Mazahari, Paris.
Congratulations to all at the arrival of a spring and revival of nature.
Ex-whistleblower Everett Stern, who talked to the 6th of January panel, said FBI agents and the House panel investigating the 6th of January attack on the Capitol have both learned of a plan by allies of retired Army General Michael Flynn to gather intelligence on top U.S. Republicans to move them to back election audits in key states that Donald Trump lost. We now present you an article written by Peter Stone. The piece is titled, Michael Flynn Allies Plotted to Lean on U.S. Republicans to Back Vote Audits. Ex-whistleblower Everett Stern, who talked to the 6th of January panel, said FBI agents and the House panel investigating the 6th of January attack on the Capitol have both learned of a plan by allies of retired Army General Michael Flynn to gather intelligence on top Republicans to move them to back election audits in key states that Donald Trump lost. Everett Stern, who runs the intelligence firm Tactical Rabbit, and is a Republican vying for a Senate seat in Pennsylvania, in multiple interviews with The Guardian, said two Flynn associates with the right-wing Patriot Caucus group enlisted his help in April in a scheme to seek potentially damaging information on two Republican members of Congress to prod them to back an audit of the 2020 presidential election that Joe Biden won. Everett Stern told The Guardian he spent several hours in November telling House panel investigators about the drive by Michael Flynn associates who sought campaign finance and other dirt on Pennsylvania Senator Pat Toomey and Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick to win their support for an audit to bolster Donald Trump's debunked charges that Joe Biden's win was fraudulent. A long-shot candidate to succeed the retiring Pat Toomey, Everett Stern said he alerted the FBI in June when he heard more details of the bizarre drive by Michael Flynn allies to specifically target the two Republicans, both of whom backed impeaching Trump after the 6th of January insurrection. The efforts by Michael Flynn's Patriot Caucus allies were launched after Donald Trump failed to block Joe Biden from taking office, and are part of a wider drive by Trump loyalists and Michael Flynn to help boost Trump's political fortunes via more state audits nationwide into charges that Biden's win was rigged and elect like-minded candidates in key states to top electoral officers. Everett Stern provided text messages, emails, and other documents revealing he had multiple contacts with one of the Patriot Caucus members, Velma Ann Ruth, and two other influential Flynn allies. Houston real estate mogul Al Hartman and former Army Green Beret Ivan Raiklin, who were pushing audits in several key states. Everett Stern said Michael Flynn's Patriot Caucus associates first approached him in Pennsylvania for possible help after an April Republican Party event, and soon after told Stern in phone calls they worked with Michael Flynn and the Patriot Caucus and planned to recruit former domestic and foreign intelligence officials to facilitate their scheme. Planned by Michael Flynn allies alarmed Everett Stern, but as a former whistleblower involved in exposing a large bank money laundering scandal by HSBC in 2012, he told The Guardian he decided to play along for a few months to glean information to expose the Trump allies' scheme. Everett Stern expressed dismay that Flynn's Patriot Caucus associates don't understand that Biden is the president. They wanted to collect information through Tactical Rabbit and my campaign to turn up the heat on Pat Toomey and Fitzpatrick to back an audit which Stern viewed as potentially extortion. Everett Stern gave The Guardian a voicemail he received in which Al Hartman talked about leaning on moderate Republican rhinos in Pennsylvania to gain support for an audit of that state's vote, with Joe Biden won by over 80,000 votes, and Al Hartman said a similar drive in Michigan was needed. Everett Stern said Al Hartman wanted to use Tactical Rabbit's intelligence gathering tools and his campaign to dig up potentially embarrassing campaign finance information and other dirt about the Pennsylvania members, plus Republican political figures in Michigan who were also resisting audits. Everett Stern said Al Hartman and Raiklin also talked with Stern about meeting Flynn, Trump's disgraced former national security advisor, and proposed compensating him for his information via campaign donations. In an April exchange of Al Hartman text messages seen by The Guardian, Al Hartman asked a Michael Flynn scheduler to help connect Flynn with Everett Stern, whose Senate campaign and credentials he touted highly, calling Stern a strong believer in their cause. Although Everett Stern tipped off the FBI in June about what he deemed a threat to national security, and he said he met with agents again in November, it's not clear if his charges are still being pursued. Everett Stern's charges have echoes of Michael Flynn's scheming with Donald Trump and other loyalists in late 2020 to thwart Joe Biden's win, efforts that included a White House meeting with Trump where Michael Flynn proposed declaring martial law in several states that Joe Biden won and then rerunning the election in those states. According to an Arizona Senate document shared by the watchdog group American Oversight to coordinate national efforts, Raiklin and Hartman on 3rd of July spearheaded one of a series of election integrity calls with Trump loyalists, lawyers and donors to discuss the status of audit efforts in several states and other plans to cast doubt on Joe Biden's win. The Arizona document reads, "Join us every second Saturday for situation updates and collaboration from active leaders in the election remediation process at state level. Attorneys with Mike Lindell and Patrick Byrne, data analysts, state legislators, gubernatorial candidates and grassroots activists whose goal is completing a cyber forensic audit in their state. A who's who list of Trump loyalists and groups invited to join these calls included the America Project and America's Future, both of which Michael Flynn played key roles with as they poured some $2 million into a discredited audit of Arizona's largest county, plus the Patriot Caucus, Velma and Ruth, Fincham and Byrne, the millionaire chief financier of the Arizona audit. Al Hartman, in emails with Everett Stern obtained by The Guardian, invited him in June to attend a religious far-right meeting known as Ziklag in Dallas, Texas, where he could meet separately with Michael Flynn. Everett Stern said Al Hartman told him a private meeting was going to be arranged with Michael Flynn, who Stern was told wanted to meet him. After indicating to Al Hartman he would attend, Everett Stern opted to cancel at the last minute, after his lawyer indicated there could be legal repercussions from such a meeting. Al Hartman has long been a donor to the right. He is on the advisory council for the pro-Trump Turning Point USA and has been active in the conservative donor network led by oil billionaire Charles Koch. According to a military official who spoke to the Reuters news agency recently, Ray Klin, an Army Reserve officer who reportedly has known Michael Flynn since 2014, is facing an internal Army Reserve investigation into possible violations of rules barring partisan political activity. Reuters has reported Ray Klin in December of 2020 outlined a wild scheme in tweets and a podcast to thwart Joe Biden's win, charging a vast conspiracy theory that included Pence, intelligence, China, and big tech. Ray Klin told Donald Trump to activate the emergency broadcast system and deployed the hashtag Fight Like a Flynn, stressing that we the people are going to force this plan on them. Neither Al Hartman or Ray Klin replied to multiple calls seeking comment. A Flynn scheduler did not respond to questions for the story. Velma Ann Ruth, with the Patriot Caucus, who was photographed with Everett Stern at a June event in Pennsylvania, said General Michael Flynn called Stern's charges delusional, fabricated, and defamatory. In a text message, Everett Stern said he shared the photo and other documents involving exchanges he had with Velma Ann Ruth with the FBI. Senior former prosecutors and intelligence officials say Everett Stern's charges merit law enforcement attention. Former prosecutor Paul Rosenzweig, who worked on Ken Starr's team during the impeachment of Bill Clinton, said Everett Stern's charges suggest serious crimes. If his allegations were corroborated by extrinsic evidence, they clearly would warrant an investigation.
Seven barometric pressure.
I come to you, and oh God, knowing that thou art our only King.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillahi ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahum. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to another episode of Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim, in this the final week of the month of Sha'ban. And because it's the final week of the month of Sha'ban and we will be entering into the blessed sanctuary of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the divine banquet of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the holy month of Ramadan, the book that we would like to introduce to our dear brothers and sisters today is a book that I myself personally have benefited from many times. It's one of the first books that I read cover to cover before I became a student, about nearly over 15, 16 years ago. And it is worth reading. It is not a very big book. It is a small book, and it is worth reading because the book will obviously help with a particular act of worship that is of extreme importance in our life in general, and especially during the holy month of Ramadan. So inshallah, in our next segment, we'll be introducing this book to our dear brothers and sisters. So please stay tuned.
Why do we read books in the first place? What are books good for?
We read books because we don't want to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
We'd better take advantage of human cultural and intellectual heritage, particularly related to our daily activities, such as our physical, mental, spiritual, or even religious health.
We can't ignore the past thoughts and experiences. To do so, we need to boost our bookshelf.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. So the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners is titled Soaring to the Only Beloved. It is a book that deals with paying attention in salah, in the prayer, and the importance of it and the possibility of it and how it is attained. The book was written by Abu Muhammad Zainul Abidin. Now, the reason I'm going to tell you who this person is, because in another book, this person becomes clear. It is our dear Sheikh Muhammad Khalfan. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala increase his life and his efforts. The book was published in Qom by Ansarian Publications. And the Sheikh says, in the present treatise, we shall briefly try to discuss the following vital issues concerning attention in prayer. So the section that I covered in this book is 1. The necessity of attention in prayer. 2. The possibility of attention in prayer. 3. Levels of attention in prayer. 4. Hurdles on the way to attention in prayer and their removal. 5. Suggested methods of achieving attention in prayer. 6. The effect of maintaining one's attention in prayer. So this is the general outline of the book. So inshallah, in our next segment, we will be reading a portion of this book for the benefit of our dear listeners. So please stay tuned.
Among the sacred texts we have received to help us understand where we came from and where we are going as a human race are most rich in helping us find our direction. They narrate stories of our past. But where have they brought us? Where are their messages now? Are we the people of belief, or have we become the people of the boxes? Is there wisdom trapped in our bookshelves? Bookshelves, bookshelves, bookshelves.
Welcome back to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. The book that we have introduced to our dear listeners was titled Soaring to the Only Beloved, a treatise that looks at the importance and the possibility and how one can attain attention in the salah, in the prayer. It was written by Sheikh Muhammad Khalfan, and obviously we heard what the Sheikh had to say. So in this particular segment, we will be reading a particular part of the treatise for the benefit of our dear listeners. And the reason why we mention this treatise now at the end of the holy month of Sha'ban is that hopefully the dear listeners will take it upon themselves to actually go and read this treatise and, you know, try and implement some of the steps that are mentioned in the prayers that we do, or that our dear brothers and sisters do in the holy month of Ramadan, in order to better acquaint ourselves, or rather to make use of the month in a better way. Section 1, the necessity of attention in prayer. How can the attention of the heart and the expression of humility not be the spirit of the prayer? And how can the perfection of prayer
not depend upon them. While the musalli, that is the person who is praying, in his prayer and supplication whispers to his Lord, Mawla Naraqi. The Holy Quran says, O you who believe, do not near prayers in the state of intoxication until you know what you say. The Holy Quran, chapter number 4, verse 43. The Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam is reported to have said, O mankind, surely when the worshippers, or the worshipper, Musalli, prays, he whispers unto his blessed and almighty Lord. Therefore he must know that with which he whispers. Rational evidence. Prayer is a kind of worship taught to the human being by his Lord through revelation to enable him to attain his proximity. Prayer is a kind of worship taught to the human being by his Lord through revelation to enable him to attain his, that is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's, proximity. It consists of a set of actions and expressions, most of which clearly declare the immaculate nature of God. A set of expressions, therefore, form an important part of the daily prayer. And clearly, the act of expression cannot really be known to be so if the heart is oblivious to what the tongue utters. Therefore, attention is a necessary concomitant of expression. And hence is also necessary in prayer. Mawla al-Naraqi, in his ethical opus, Jami'a Sa'adat, says, how can the presence of the heart and the expression of humility not be the spirit of the prayer? And how can the perfection of prayer not depend upon them? While the worshipper, Musalli, in his prayer and supplication, whispers to his Lord, there is no doubt that speech, along with absent-mindedness, is not the act of whispering. In addition, speech is an expression of what is in the heart or mind. And this is impossible save by means of the attention of the heart. For what really does the supplicant ask when he says, guide us on the straight path, while the heart is inattentive? And there is no doubt also that the purpose behind Quranic recitation and invocations, adhkar, is the act of laudation, praise, the expression of one's humility, and supplication while the addressee is the Almighty Allah. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us in these last few days of the holy month of Sha'ban. And when we enter into the glorious and blessed month of Shahr Ramadan, we are able to pay careful attention to what we are saying and who we are addressing in order to gain the true benefit from the acts that we do and in order for us to truly attain sincerity and ikhlas in our actions. So inshallah, I hope and I pray that our acts and efforts in this month of Sha'ban is accepted and we have a fruitful Shahr Ramadan. Inshallah, until next time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf with Brother Yasser Ibrahim on RIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio.